Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
If the next voice you hear sounds like a 12-year-old boy, you can understand why Jamie Johnston worked in voiceover for years. She is now author of a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. She was born and grew up in Los Angeles. Her father, actor-singer Johnny Johnston, had a starring role in the 1956 movie Rock Around the Clock. In 1972, Jamie Johnston and her songwriting partner were one of the first female rock bands to get a major record deal. They played their own instruments and wrote their own songs. Jamie went on to study acting with Lee Strasberg and appeared in several films and theater productions. In 2018, Jamie Johnston moved to Paradise, where she lost her home in the campfire. Jamie Johnston, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Now, I was kidding about the fact that your voice may sound like a 12-year-old, because you have, in the past, done voiceover.
A lot of animation, a lot of dubbing. What it was, you know, was really funny. I just had that quality of like a 12-year-old boy, and I used to say I do the best 12-year-old boy in town. And you could always tell sometimes when you're watching cartoons, and you could tell it's a woman doing, you know, right? And so I tested it out one day, and I called, I think it's Charles Melendez or whoever did Charlie Brown, and I called them up and I said, hey, my mom says that I can call you guys and ask, you know, if I can, like, do an audition or something. And they said, well, how old are you? And I said, 12. And they said, well, you know, you're a little older than the ones, you know, the kids that we use, but thanks for calling.
So you missed out on the job doing Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the movie Rock Around the Clock.
Yeah.
I do not remember your dad. I remember Bill Haley in the comics.
Oh, sure.
But I thought maybe it's on YouTube. And I Googled, and there is your dad, this handsome blonde, smoking a pipe. He's the main character in this 1956 movie.
Yeah.
Your dad.
Yeah.
So I think people would be curious, well, if you've had all these adventures, how in the world did you get your start? I'm going to ask you if you would read the very first chapter, because you give titles to your chapters that I hear in my head as a song. So if you would like to start reading, just in your chapter one.
This whole part here?
Yeah.
Chapter one. There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to. It is surely significant that the first date I can conjure in my childhood's mind is 1960. That would make me about seven. Just about the age of reasoning. Even my first LP record, Around the World with the Chipmunks and David Seville, came out in 1960. Though I was born in the 50s, I was spared any vivid recollection of them, with the exception of Dick Clark and American Bandstand, a telltale staple of my childhood viewing, much to my grandmother's dismay. It said a lot about me as a preschool-age child, sitting on the floor in my sleepers, rocking back and forth to that primal rhythm. A premonition of you, if you will, of things to come. I will say that it is obvious to anyone who has ever gotten to know me in the slightest that music is my frame of reference for everything. I tend to talk in song lyrics and pop music parables. It's a habit I don't remember beginning, and there seems to be no end. Music has always been my salvation and my hell on earth. I have afforded it that much power over me. One of the first things my six-year-old ears remembers hearing in the ethers was older school-age children singing, "Whistle While You Work, Nixon is a Jerk." I learned that Kennedy, he of the youth and vigor, was good, and that Nixon, he of the shifty eyebrows and 5 o'clock shadow, was bad. Those snippets of early indoctrination weren't lost on me. Perhaps lifelong carrying liberals were born into a different kind of awareness, whereas some sorts of people shut the windows and pull down the shades to a gathering storm, preferring the safe, unquestioning mindset of the status quo. Some are almost predestined to throw them wide open and invite the tornado into tea. I was one of those. My mother has said that I was always rooting for the underdog, always marching for a cause. That's good to know because I was conveniently blessed with being born into an era that had plenty of causes to go around. Like so many of the younger baby boomers, my first clear memory of any historical reference being the Kennedy assassination. I think I missed the Cuban Missile Crisis. It wasn't difficult to grow up with a healthy distrust of the government and believing everything was a conspiracy. It is no wonder many in my generation are paranoid. Some of us even grew up to create TV shows like The X-Files.
This is my guest, Jamie Johnston, and she's reading from a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. Now, when I see the title of your book, Following Breadcrumbs, I think, well, the only breadcrumbs I knew that followed were Hansel and Gretel, when this fairy tale that these two little kids followed breadcrumbs. So you do explain for us what that expression means.
Following breadcrumbs refers to the process by which any of us who have followed a dream will look to those who have traveled that path before. Then, if we are fortunate enough to have achieved that dream and then experience a great fall from grace, we may spend the rest of our lives following our own breadcrumbs, trying to recreate in some form the circumstances that brought us to that first triumph. Most of us never find it again.
And thus the title of your book, Following Breadcrumbs. There's also, in your introduction, you talk about crazy stories of 6 degrees of separation. You could say you could fill a tome on that.
Yeah.
So your title, Following Breadcrumbs, so you find in your life it seems like you're following breadcrumbs. And you also use this expression, 6 degrees of separation.
Sure.
And I think maybe there are a lot of listeners who could say, oh, yeah, I understand. I've experienced that. So what do you mean by 6 degrees of separation, Jamie?
Well, people in my life all seem connected. And it was at the point where it was like getting kind of crazy, like, relationships that I've had, especially with men in my life, they all knew each other. They were all connected in music. The 60s and 70s, most of these guys were older than me. They were about 9 or 10 years older than me. So they all knew each other and they had all worked together. But for some reason, and I wasn't looking for it, but they they ended up in my life. And it was just a very cosmic thing. Ah, the Cosmic Ranger.
Ah, yes. Now, there's an expression you use in your book, the Cosmic Ranger.
Yes.
And people Jamie, what do you mean by the Cosmic Ranger?
Well, you would call him, I guess, God or the creator or, the ombudsman of, the great spiritual realm. The guy who puts it all together, that makes it happen. And you go, what exactly just happened?
So when you, in your book, from time to time refer to the Cosmic Ranger, that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Your reader may, or the listeners may have another label that they like to put on that, but that's the label that you give it.
Yes.
Which doesn't belong to any particular religion, for example.
No.
The Cosmic Ranger. Now, you mentioned the title of this first chapter that you read because I just had so much fun just reading the titles of your book because they sang to me. I would read a title, and up in my head would be the tune to those very words, the titles of your chapters.
Do you want me to read a few?
Yeah.
Chapter 1, There's a World Where I Can Go and Tell My Secrets To.
You're just going to read? You're not going to sing the titles?
No. Well, I could, Chapter 2, So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. Okay. Chapter 3, Stop, Hey, What's That Sound?
Everybody look what's
okay.
going
Exactly.
Around.
Chapter 4, Rebel, Rebel, How Could They Know? Okay. Chapter 5, Time It Was and What a Time It Was, It Was. Chapter 6, Looking for Fun and Feeling Groovy. Chapter 7, How Does It Feel to Be One of the Beautiful People? So and it goes on from there. If you're going to San Francisco.
If you're going to San Francisco.
Chapter 11, Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man,
Play
a song for me, and that's a very important.
Oh, yeah. That one jumped off the page for
yes,
me.
Yes, it did. It jumped off the page at me, too.
When people hear these lyrics as your chapter titles, they might understand why the artwork on your cover is such.
Yeah.
Describe the artwork on your cover.
It's a miracle, really, because I I explained to the graphics part of the company that put the book out, that I wanted something that reflected the 60s and music and blah, blah, blah. Somebody, some brilliant person came up with this font. I kind of said I wanted a kind of like a Fillmore font or a Woodstock font or something like that. They came up with that. But not only that, they put the title in tie-dye.
Which yeah, the I word thought, following breadcrumbs looks like a tie-dye, like
tie-dye.
T-shirts.
Yeah, I was amazed. And I kept saying, well, who did this? Who did this? Let me thank them. And I never found out who actually did it.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and she has been on the music in the music scene since she was a little girl.
Little girl.
And so her book subtitled Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And I asked her if she would read from chapter one. And I'm going to ask you now if you will jump to the very last paragraph in your first chapter, Jamie.
Ah, yes. The Beach Boys, at least in my life, were setting the stage for something totally earth-shattering, something so incredible in the history of the world it can't even be accurately described. The feeling in the air, almost a vibration that, like exceptional dogs, only a chosen few could hear. It permeated every moment of every day leading up to that first night on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9, 1964, when we saw the Beatles for the first time. Like homing pigeons, we all knew where to be that night. That cultural shift was as momentous for us as it was for our elders, who had watched a widow following a riderless horse and a flag-draped casket only 3 months earlier. For us, it was that cataclysmic. We would never be the same.
This is Jamie Johnston reading from her memoir, Following Breadcrumbs. And your dad was a movie star, but he was not born in Hollywood.
No, he was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but he grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, which also figures large in this story later on.
We're reading chapter two about your dad, we don't realize later in the book how that's going to come up again.
Oh, big time.
But you described him as a blonde, dimple-chinned, gorgeous crooner who had the distinction of playing a guitar when all the other crooners of the late 40s and early 50s were in front of a microphone.
Yes. Yeah.
And you say he was nominated for a Tony for his role in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn on Broadway with Shirley Booth.
Yep.
He was under contract to MGM and Paramount, where he made pictures there. So your dad, he made a movie with Esther Williams and Jimmy Durante. I'm assuming he met a lot of beautiful women, but he chose to marry one.
Yes, my mom. Well, first, he married Catherine Grayson. Yes.
And I remember that name as an actress. Yeah.
Yes. And then I guess years later, not that long later, he met my mom, and they were of a type. They were all dark-haired. He loved brunettes.
You mean the women, because he was blonde, yes.
Yes, it's very unusual.
So he liked brunettes.
Yes.
Yeah. So you say your dad enlisted Jimmy Durante as his messenger boy.
Right.
To carry love notes back and forth between the sets.
Yeah, to Catherine Grayson, right.
Yeah, to Catherine Grayson. So
that got him in major trouble, by the way.
Oh,
He got let go by the studio head. Yeah.
You say that.
Yeah, yeah.
You say just like that, Dad was suddenly let out of his Metro contract.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you say there was a story about how the role of Julie LaVerne in Showboat was going to go to Lena Horne.
Yes. Yeah.
But if people don't remember the skin color of Lena Horne.
Right, right. Yeah.
So they didn't give that.
Yeah, the code. What do you call it? Have you got that mark there about the?
Yeah, you want to look?
I'll look at your copy. It's better than mine. Showboat. Because of 1951's now antiquated production code, which wouldn't allow interracial couples to be shown on the screen, that part was given to her friend Ava Gardner. Lena was so heartbroken, but so was Ava, who really didn't want to take the role away from Lena. My mother had a wealth of stories such as this and should have written her own book.
And you know, that made me, I don't know that much about Ava Gardner, but when I read that, that made me admire her.
Yeah.
For that.
Oh, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. My dad was friends with Ella Fitzgerald, and at the time when he was in Vegas, like everybody was in the 50s, and they weren't allowing, you know, her to come in through the front door, like, you know.
Yeah.
And he made a big stink about that. My dad, who was rather conservative himself.
And here he was in this famous rock and roll movie, so he must have liked rock and roll.
No, he hated rock and roll. Hated rock and roll and never let me forget it.
Oh, here he raises a rock and roll girl child.
Yeah,
and
a bona fide pedigree, yes.
So, I think you say he actually did smoke a pipe, because in the movie,
yes,
he smoked a pipe. So there was your gorgeous mother. In fact, you have a photograph of your mother. Oh,
yeah.
What a glamour shot
yeah,
that
is. Yeah,
she
was really beautiful. Really beautiful.
In fact, I looked at your photographs when I first opened the book, but then some of the characters, you had not explained who they were, so I looked back at the photographs from time to time when you would introduce a new character.
There's the picture of me with the Beatle haircut in 1964. My
yeah.
mother was thrilled about that.
I think you're speaking ironically, yes?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, your mother was not fond of that.
No.
You say you, like a punch in the stomach, I remember exactly where I was when I first heard Eve of Destruction
yeah.
in the autumn of 1965.
Yeah, did you mark that or do I?
Well, you can take a look at that, what
yeah.
you say
yeah.
about that.
Whew. The explosion heard throughout the city in the summer of 1965 was written down in the history books as the Watts Riots. I was lost in the rather privileged, insulated world of the white upper class, middle class. Viewing the riots from Beverly Hills was truly bizarre. I remember feeling angry and guilty at the same time, the kind of guilt I'd always felt as a protected and pampered white kid living in plenty, while I constantly noticed others who had so much less. At my parents' social gatherings, I was often finding refuge in the kitchen with the colored help. Somehow it just felt more comfortable and real there. Like a punch in the stomach, I remember exactly where I was when I first heard Eve of Destruction in the autumn of 1965. The dreadful pall that I felt with that record was unreal. I think I stopped breathing. The death knell of the drum, the simple acoustic intro, and the sandpaper voice of Barry McGuire combined sent chills down my spine. And I remember after that becoming acutely aware of the name P.F. Sloan in association with not only that song, but other songs that graced my 45s and album covers, which I read voraciously word for word. It is no wonder that I could recite the producer, writer, and every group member of any band off the record, off any record of that time. A little more than 20 years later, Phil Sloan and I would become embroiled in a turbulent 9-year yo-yo of a relationship which rivaled that fabled topsy-turvy trip down a well-known rabbit hole.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and her book is a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Child. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Paradise author Jamie Johnston, reading from her memoir, Following Breadcrumbs. And these breadcrumbs took you to London?
Yeah, London.
And how did that come about?
Oh, well, where do you... Okay.
Actually, you had seen Paul McCartney before you
went
to London.
Indeed.
You were 11 years old.
Yeah.
So this was 8 years before you actually got to sit down and have a beer with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, no. Yes.
But how did you happen to see Paul McCartney when you were only 11 years old?
Very few pictures exist of me from that time, but an interesting thing occurred in 1995 when the Beatles anthology was being released. On a local TV station in L.A., they showed some footage taken 30 years earlier outside the Beatles' Benedict Canyon hideaway, just a couple miles away from where I was conveniently living at the time with my mother and stepfather. There in grainy black and white, standing out in the crowd amongst much larger kids, was my 11-year-old self. They caught me on camera running and jumping onto the limousine as it made its way out through the gates.
So here was Paul McCartney in
a
limousine,
was
and
in the
there you are, 11-year-old.
They caught me on camera screaming my head off at him. How funny, how strange. I would share a beer with him in a London recording studio overlooking Oxford Street just 8 years later.
So you first get photographed on Paul McCartney's limousine.
Right.
Then 8 years later, you happened to go to London because you and a friend were your own, well, you had your own name of your musical group. Do I call it a group? Duo.
Yep. Yeah. My friend Sandy from Fairfax High School. How we met. It started out simply with a line of dialogue from A Hard Day's Night. I threw one out at her, complete with full Beatle intonations, and she answered me back right in kind, straight from the script. She had passed the test. She knew early on that she had found the perfect songwriting partner in me before I did. Sandy held it all together for me and kept me focused for the next 14 years. It kind of fell into place one day as we were sitting around Sandy's mother's kitchen table making a list of prospective names for our little merry band that consisted of only just the two of us. By then, we had written some songs and had a vague notion that the world might be ready for a couple of girls who at first looked and sounded like a Mercy Beat version of the Indigo Girls, though they wouldn't exist for at least another 15 years. We came up with the name The Skiffles. First, because it ended in the proverbial good luck charm of L.E.S. Second, because it was a cute nod to the origins of our heroes who began as a skiffle band. Skiffle was what Americans would have called jug band music. On November 15, 1972, the Skiffles signed a recording contract with Beatles producer George Martin.
George Martin.
Yes.
I think if readers are reading this, they think, what?
Yeah, see, this is why I had to write a book. People go, oh, no one's ever going to believe that rubbish. Yeah. And you were only 19 and 18 at the time.
Yeah. And you had the photographic evidence. You don't have the actual piece of paper anymore.
No, I don't. But I lost it in the fire.
Yeah. In the campfire. So you go to London.
Yeah.
And you meet George Martin.
Yeah. Your face. Yeah, you should see your face, folks. Yeah. But this is weird. This is weird. It couldn't be more bizarre irony than Paul McCartney being the one that became the fly for our ointment. Paul decided to break the ice with Mr. Martin after a long sabbatical and returned to the fold to record Live and Let Die for the next James Bond film. The Skiffles didn't stand a bloody chance in hell.
To borrow a British bloody.
Yeah.
So Paul McCartney knocked you out of your opportunity.
Yeah, he didn't. He was great. I mean,
he didn't do it on purpose.
He didn't, but I mean, but it's just strange. And it's strange that years later I became friends with one of the members of his band, Wings. And
In fact,
goes on and on.
It seems like I recall he wanted to buy a musical instrument
from
you.
He did. Yes. Sandy, my partner, had a Hofner bass, which is McCartney's known for, the violin-shaped bass. And what we didn't know at the time, he explained it, but he had just had one of his Hofner basses stolen from a van in Notting Hill Gate. And he actually asked Sandy if she wanted to sell it to him. And bless her heart, she said no.
So you go to London, and then what happened then as you continue? Did you continue as the Skiffles?
For a while. Broke, defeated, and emotionally drained, we return to the States to lick our wounds and regroup. But how does one recover after getting so close to the light and then burning to a crisp? Where do you go after having had the biggest record producer in the world? By the middle of 1980, I was ensconced at Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. On the evening of December 8th, 1980, around 8 p.m., I was driving on my way to a club called the Starwood, which just so happened to be down the road from the Institute. The nightmarish news broke on the radio. John Lennon had been shot in New York. There wasn't a day that went by since I was 10 years old that when I picked up my guitar, I didn't see John Lennon's face in my head. He was the beginning for me, the reason I started, and he was the end. I found it impossible to play after his murder. The trauma was that heavy. Nothing was like this, not for me. It would send me spinning off uncontrollably into an empty void, untethered for years without a foundation or direction. I took my shingle down and shuttered the windows, put the guitar away in its case. I was done.
You know, I asked you about 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah.
And back many years ago, there's a guy named Charlie Manson.
Oh, yeah.
Who is still in prison, as far as I know, for
oh, he died.
Murder.
He died.
Yeah. But he yes. spent the rest of his life in prison.
Yes, he did.
And what was that 6 degrees of separation with Charlie Manson?
A friend of mine, actually, it's incredible. I met him when I was like 16, maybe. He was 18, and he was on tour in the States to promote his movie, Romeo and Juliet. So it was Leonard Whiting. And we became friends after this. But my mother had gone to a party, and his manager was there. And his manager happened to own that house on Cielo Drive, where Manson was looking for Terry Melcher, who was also connected to all the people in my life, because Terry Melcher produced, he worked with P.F. Sloan, and he also had produced the Byrds albums, the first two albums. So I said that gave him major cred for me. You know, he was Doris Day's son, but he also produced the Byrds' first two albums. But he went to stay in that house about maybe 2 or 3 months after the murders. And I went up there to visit him at the house. So I saw it. I saw where they had written in blood on the door and everything. That house was actually taken down. I think it was totally, you know, I guess not remodeled, but actually, you know, taken down. And something else is in its place. I believe Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails might have gotten the house, but I'm not sure.
So I want to ask you about a young man who asked you to marry him, and he had a very interesting background. Now, some of these musical groups that people probably have heard of, the Turtles, for example?
Yes.
And what was your connection to the Turtles, Jamie?
Oh, well, there were a lot of connections. My friend P.F. Sloan had written a couple of songs for them. You Baby and Let Me Be were big hits. But that's not really how I knew the Turtles. I didn't really know the Turtles until I met Don. And that happened because of my connection to surfing. And I went down to the Santa Monica Pier in August of 1994 to see the Safaris and Dick Dale. And my connection to the Safaris was only that I was able to play Wipeout on my desk better than anybody else at school.
I might ask you to spell Safaris because it sounds like this.
Yes.
Okay.
It's Surfaris. So Don had been playing drums for the Safaris for like 15 years, but before that, he was the original drummer for the Turtles. And so I was sort of dating P.F. Sloan at the time. And so when they announced from the stage that Don Murray, the original drummer for the Turtles, was there, I just went, oh, you know, I really need to go say hello to him. Yeah. What I didn't know was that, you know, back in the 60s, he and Phil Sloan had had a disagreement over the drum part, the syncopated drum part, for You Baby, which actually starts out the song. If you ever listen to the song by the Turtles, You Baby, you'll hear the drum part, and it's almost like what rap, you know, what rap drumming became, in a way. Nothing like rap, but the drum beat was very unusual. And Sloan didn't like it at all. So they had a major falling out. I didn't know that. So, you know, when I went to meet him, you know.
When you went to meet Don.
Don, it was very, very romantic. I asked the guard to have him come over to the fence. They were, you know, behind a security fence. And I told him who I was. And I looked at him, and it was just instant something. And even though he had that uncomfortable feeling about, you know, the background of, you know, who I was kind of seeing at the time, he didn't forget me either. And several months later, I got him on the phone, and it went from there.
So the two of you fell in love, you and Don Murray, who was this talented drummer.
And an artist. He had worked for Hanna-Barbera as an animator, as a, you know, a colorist, and did some things. And his artwork was incredible, and I lost all of that in the fire, too.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and her book is Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. So here's your connection. A lot of bands that I think as people read your book, oh, yeah, I remember the Turtles, or I remember the Birds. So you have this romantic relationship, you and Don, very much in love with each other.
Yeah.
But you didn't get married.
No. He had some medical issues, big-time medical issues that it kind of he underplayed. He had an ulcer that caused him, well, a bleeding ulcer, and he had to go into the hospital for surgery because he was having trouble digesting anything. So he went into the hospital. This was January 1996. We'd been together only a year and a half, 18 months. And we surfed together. We had set up house together. We were really having a life. And it was the first time that I really had a life with a man, you know, like for real. And my mother adored him. And so he went into the hospital, and things went terribly wrong. He was there for 3 months. He had like three more surgeries. And the sepsis was what killed him. And he never came home again.
And you know something that just almost made me cry, because I think people who've lost a loved one, whether it's a child or a spouse, understand. You said that his toothbrush.
Yeah.
Just left his toothbrush.
I left his toothbrush for almost 10 years in the apartment we were living in Playa del Rey. We were not far from the beach. We used to surf, you know, down in Manhattan Beach and all over in. I couldn't move his toothbrush. I was sort of like frozen in time.
Yeah, I think people can sympathize with that. Well, you did fall in love again.
Yes.
And one of the titles in your book has Mr. Tambourine Man in it.
Yeah, actually, Mr. Tambourine Man was before Don. That's what's unusual. Uh-huh. So, yeah. Gene Clark.
And now people might want, Mr. Tambourine Man, yeah, I remember that song, but you haven't mentioned who made that song famous.
Well, Bob Dylan wrote it, yeah. So, Bob Dylan wrote it. That's the other thing that the Turtles and the Birds had in common. They both hit the scene big time with Bob Dylan songs. And what's the really strange thing is that Don Murray had left the Turtles before they did Happy Together. He left the Turtles in 1966. And Gene Clark also left the Birds in 1966. So
Gene Clark is a name that people may not know. So who was Gene Clark?
Gene was the songwriter of the band, much to the other guy's consternation. He made more money, and there was a bit of, you know, a bit of sort of back and forth over that. He was able to, you know, buy a nice Porsche and all these other things. But the weird thing is about Gene is that when I was 12 years old, my mother and I were living very close to the Whiskey Go-Go off the Sunset Strip. And I was 12 years old wandering around the strip, you know, and I just happened to be kitty corner to the Whiskey Go-Go. This is after he had left the birds, and I saw him walking in through the door at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And I knew immediately who he was, but, you know, I had no feelings for him, no other than he, oh, there's Gene Clark, you know. So it was 20 years later that we met.
Well, when you described him, I thought, well, I want to see pictures of him. So I went online and, yeah. Oh my gosh, gorgeous. What a handsome, oh yes.
Yeah, gorgeous. He was Native American and Indian. You could do the math about other things on that. Which is why he had a lot of problems that, you know, kind of almost hereditary. But he was really a handsome guy.
And you're putting that in the past tense because you tell us that he was found dead at age 46.
46. We had been kind of dancing around each other for 4 years. I knew that he was kind of surrounded by these sycophants and people, you know, bringing him all kinds of substances to sort of, you know, as a pass to get into his life. He had been seeing somebody. I didn't know this, you know, when I met him, but she was a drug dealer girlfriend, and it was a really a bad scene. And at the time, I met him at a club called the Central on Sunset Strip, which became the Viper Room, where River Phoenix died outside. That girlfriend of his was in jail for dealing, and I didn't even know it until years later because I thought, well, you know, so that made things – he was available sort of at the time. But I became sort of like his safe place to be, his place to be quiet and to – be real away from the whole scene at his house in Sherman Oaks where people would just show up and parties and whatever going on. And he just needed a safe place to be. And since I didn't do drugs or drink, which is how unusual is that?
Yes, I think people would be surprised because you're surrounded by it.
I'm surrounded by it. I was surrounded by it even as a little kid, hanging around and seeing, you know, older kids just passed out in the halls at Pandora's Box, which is the famous club where the Sunset Strip riots took place, yes. And I was there, actually, that day, but earlier in the day. And then the riots took place that night. And this is the song that was written for What It's Worth, Buffalo Springfield. Yeah. So that was about that.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and she lives in Paradise now, but she was living in Southern California at the time she was writing, living quite a life. After a break, Jamie Johnston and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Paradise author Jamie Johnston, and she has a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And she has told us about two men that she was in love with, both of whom died. And then when Gene Clark died, he had a brother.
He did. He had several brothers. He comes from a family of 13 kids. 13 kids! He rarely talked about his family. I had a feeling that he felt kind of out of a fish out of water. I don't know. He was in this L.A. scene, and I don't know. He kind of must have felt...
Well, when Gene was hospitalized, you spent a lot of time going. He was in the hospital a long time. And so you...
No. When Don was hospitalized,
me.
Yeah.
But Rick had problems also.
Yeah.
What was the nature... you served as a caretaker for Gene Clark's brother, Rick.
That happened 20 years after Gene had died.
20 years.
I took the opportunity... For, you know, it just happened that they were holding a Gene Clark symposium in Kansas City, which is where he was from. And I got in my car and I drove all the way to Kansas City from L.A. and went to this thing for no reason. I didn't know these people, but I just went because I had heard that some of his family was going to be there. And I felt I really had to tell them who I was. I had nothing to gain. No, I didn't want anything. I just wanted them to know that he had a dream of leaving L.A. and starting again in Mendocino, and he had promised me that we were going to go up
there. He gave you a ring.
He gave me a ring, and he made no big deal about it at all. He made it look like it was just a friendship ring. But after he died, I put the ring away, and I wouldn't look at it, and I wouldn't listen to his music for 20 years.
Now, since you mentioned a trip to Missouri,
yes,
you had another connection to Missouri,
yes,
and that was
my dad. My dad. He was born in St. Louis, but he grew up in Kansas City, and the Clark family had a place. They started out in an area called Swope Park, and my father had hung out there in the woods, and I found out years later from a cousin that that's where my dad had hung out. That's so freaky.
And where your dad was buried.
He is buried. Well, he was—
I don't mean in the park, but yeah. Missouri has a connection to your heart in two ways.
Yes, a lot of ways. And when I finally went back there, it was just unbelievable. The family, you know, I wrote them a letter— I wrote them a letter and told them who I was.
We're talking about Gene Clark's family now.
Yes, Gene Clark's family. And tried to explain, you know, that he it really wasn't supposed to end like that, that he really was trying to sort of get himself together at the end, but these people just kept sucking him in. That's how that happened. Then I overheard one of the brothers, David Clark, talking to one of the fans about the younger brother who had gone to California back in 1970 to be a singer-songwriter too. And, they'd lost track of him. He was somewhere in Northern California. They didn't know exactly where. But the way that David described it was really kind of it sent up every red flag for me because he said that he was in some kind of a place, a halfway house or something, and that he was in trouble.
So this is now, just to review— Gene's older brother, David, is telling you about this younger brother
who's actually in trouble.
Oh,
David isn't older. He's actually younger, too.
Okay.
Gene was, he was the second oldest.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, David is telling you about this brother that he and Gene had,
mm-hmm.
and this brother's name is Rick,
right.
And he's in trouble.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. I hadn't met Rick back in the 80s. I'd seen him at a couple of shows. I remember Rick was mentioned from the stage, you know, Gene had mentioned him, and I turned around and looked, and there's this, you know, cute blonde boy, oh my God. And, you know, but I never went up to him, I never said anything to him, and so 20 years goes by, and there I am. As I drove back to California from Kansas City, that's all I could think about is, where is this guy, where is he, and what can I do? What can I do? So somebody that knew him found his number, called him, and had Rick call me from where he was in this place, where he was very ill, where if I hadn't gotten up there to Eureka, California when I did in February of 2012, he might have died. He was in really bad shape. That was February 2012, and we are still together.
So you took care of him when his health was failing.
Yeah.
And you keep taking care of him when you move to Paradise.
Yeah.
And you and Rick and your dogs fled the fire in Paradise.
Yeah.
Now, you've had such a life, Jamie, that I want to go back, because when I hear things like this, I think, what's the lesson here?
Yeah, what's the lesson?
And you surely have learned from this life that you have lived. And one of the things that you say, and you refer to a teacher you had when you were a kid, and she was wondering what you were going to learn because she thought you really did have a heart. And one thing you say, I learned to truly love.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else did you learn that the rest of us could benefit from what this life that you have lived, and you have had such opportunities to learn lessons?
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't just these two people how I learned.
Oh, no.
My partner, my songwriting partner, Sandy.
And excuse me, but people need to read your book to get a bigger picture of people that entered your life.
Totally.
Oh, my gosh.
But that particular teacher had, you know, just said, you know, your arrogance. This was something she wrote in my high school yearbook, you know, about your arrogance and this and that.
She says, she wrote in my Fairfax High School yearbook, Jamie, somewhere underneath that crass exterior of yours and your belligerence and your hostility and your ego is a warm, sympathetic, talented person. I hope she comes out soon. We'll all be much happier. And
Mrs.
then
Stevenson.
You're answering Mrs. Stevenson, and you said, at least I learned to truly love.
Yeah.
Perhaps that was the lesson after all.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I was a pretty bad kid. I didn't do drugs, right? I wasn't involved in.
But you
in
got kind of, kicked out of
well,
schools.
Well, I got kicked out of six schools and two summer camps. And I look at it like, well, okay, I was just a little bit too honest. I'm very blunt. I say what I think, and I ask too many questions. And and I got in trouble all the time.
Well, like I say, we've just barely scratched the surface of what's in your book, Following Breadcrumbs. In fact, I had a conversation with a friend about where the twists and turns in his life, and I used your expression. I said, it sounds like you are following breadcrumbs. He said, yes.
Yeah.
So I think people will get learn from your book in a lot of ways, Jamie. Thank you for writing this book.
Thank you. I mean, everybody told me I had to write a book. I started it in 1998, and I just kept putting it down because it was just too heavy, because that was just 2 years after Don had died. I just kept writing. I had to.
Well, thank you again. And I'll remind listeners, the title of your book is Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And the author is Jamie Johnston. Thank you, Jamie. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The request. Here are some things Pammy reminds me about. Stop wearing bell-bottom jeans while I'm gardening. When I have to rush off to the store in them and my flip-flops, I don't look very fashionable. But I think they're coming back, I'm sure. I need to get more frequent haircuts, because when the wind blows my hair, it looks like a keratin corkscrew twisting in the wind. I need to use her bright magnifying mirror to pluck those errant hairs from the tip of my nose. It hurts when she does it, although she promises she won't. Wearing clothes made from friendly fabric, not flammable polyester. Practice using my iPhone calendar, not standing stock still in the appointment desk, pretending I know what I'm doing. I don't. And after about 5 minutes, they know I don't as well. I need to remember to mute my phone so that it doesn't interrupt the Hamlet soliloquy at the Shakespeare Festival. I need to lower my phone's volume. Not everyone wants to hear about my upcoming colonoscopy. I need to sync my iPhone and car phone to Bluetooth so that passengers don't have to hear my primary care physician bawl me out. I need to start clipping my toenails at some other place and not on the bed, because they start flying like some unmanned drones over to Pam's side. She's not very happy with that. Using appropriate names like Starbucks coffee, short, tall, grande, venti, stop calling them large, medium, little, small, and tiny. She says I sound like Goldilocks at the Three Bears. I need to be sure to end my phone calls properly, so that the person I called doesn't hear me say, "Jeez, I thought that phone call would never end." I need to stop arranging the room furniture to help me up after I'm playing on the carpet with my grandkids. Hint, rocking chairs are not to be trusted. I need to drink margaritas more slowly to avoid brain freeze. I need to stop calling grown grandchildren by their nicknames. It was cute when they were three, but I think Come On Giesel has kind of run its course. I need to come up with some new names, or just address them by their real names. I need to stop mocking and yelling at the "your call is very important to us." Pam says I'm picking a fight with a recording. I never looked at it like that, but I think she's right. I need to stop putting the CVS receipt around my neck like the scarf Betty Davis wore in the movie The Letter. You can Google that, 1940. I need to stop saying Gesundheit to unseen people in the darkened theater. I'm just being polite, you know, but they have never said thank you. Okay, sneeze at your own risk. I'm not sure I can do all of them, maybe one per month. So check back in April of 2027, and I'll keep you posted.
The essence of his chaos. Sweetest glory upon those who can see the permanence and peace in the forever changing nature and chaos that is time. Reflecting upon the demise of hollow indignation brings about feelings of abandonment and isolation that make up the average artist's fractured mind. To see through the smoke of his existence is a chore for anyone who is brave enough and resilient enough to endure his world, which is sort of like being in a rock tumbler. Those who can stand the eyes of burning smoke, the endless tangents that hide sparkles of genius that are hard to pick out due to the nature of a tangent, are some of the toughest people who exist. So many would come out in rapid-fire succession that the barrel gets hot and spews venom upon those who dare to get in the crossfires of his analytical weaponry. Oftentimes, the weaponry is aimed at himself. Moments of self-depreciating honesty that shake him to the core. Yet he chooses not to stop. Chaos ensues, but he lives for it. He feeds off of it as he swims in the waves of blood and joy, batting away those sharks and saltwater crocs that salivate at the chance to rip him into pieces. He endures because his soul is both calloused and raw, tender and scabbed, ruined and reborn. David Gregory.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.